Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see
600,000,
yeah, you're looking
deducted.
At it. Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here. Oh, man. He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written, and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, I said, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes. I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see. Oh,
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
By the time you met Blondon, how big were you getting? Like, how much were you buying on a regular basis?
Oh, no, maybe a couple pounds, 16 pounds maybe.
16 pounds?
Yeah, 8 pounds, something like that. Okay. At that time, pounds were going for 35,000 a pound, yeah.
By the time you met Blondon, how much cash did you have?
I don't know. I had a few hundred thousand.
A few hundred thousand. So you weren't a millionaire back then, but you were well off.
I was doing good.
You was doing good.
I was doing pretty good.
So how did the whole Blondon thing come together?
Well, see, we were still getting from the Blondon, but we wasn't going directly to Blondon.
It was a middleman.
It was a middleman. So the only thing happened when we met him personally was that the middleman had got cut out, which dropped the price even more. But we were already getting it from Blondon, technically.
Technically.
Yeah.
You just weren't talking to him.
I just wasn't talking to him.
Okay. So how did you end up meeting him?
I bought him.
You bought him?
Mm-hmm.
So you basically bought your connect.
Yeah.
So you told your middleman, I'm going to give you...
$60,000.
$60,000, and you introduced me to your connect. And you could walk away with that $60,000.
Yep. And then Blondon paid $60,000 as well.
To meet you.
Yeah, to meet me.
So the connect got $120,000 mm-hmm. to essentially... walk away from that part of the business?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he got spooked, I heard. You know, somebody had got busted.
He was trying to get out of the game? He was
trying to get out of the game, so he felt, you know, he'd take $160,000, go back to Honduras, and live like a king.
$120,000. And that's what he did? He left?
I guess, yeah, for a while.
Okay. So now you're working with the Connect. Blondon.
Yep.
How is that relationship different than your previous relationship?
We got a lot tighter, you know. Me and Blondon hung out a little bit together. You know, I would go over his house. The other guys were more meet on the street, switch cash for money, you know, money for drugs, and it's over. But me and Brandon, we kind of hung out. We talked about business. So we developed kind of what I thought was a friendship as well.
Okay. Now, Blandone is the one that actually took you to the next level.
Technically, yeah, and no, you know.
Explain.
I mean, we took each other to the next level.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
You know, I wasn't, I wasn't out here helpless and homeless. You know, when I met him, I had a few $100,000 and I had clientele. I knew the streets. You know, I knew all the shot callers from every hood in L.A., you know. So he helped, but, you know, not by himself.
According to some articles that I looked up, and you can tell me whether this is accurate or not, it said that you were making up to $3 million a day.
I've had days that I made $3 million.
You had a $3 million day?
Yeah.
Okay.
A few of them.
A few of them. Explain how you have a $3 million day.
Well, your big customers come through, a couple of them, and they drop off $200,000, $300,000. There were three or four spots that I had in L.A. where guys just stood out on the street that would make $100,000 a day, each one.
Each one?
Yeah.
Now, this actually built up. I guess you had operations in 42 cities?
I don't know how many cities. I mean,
a lot of cities.
We had a lot of cities.
All throughout the country.
Yeah.
So explain to me, and, okay.
You know, different people do their estimates and their calculations and all
right.
that stuff. So.
And I guess the other thing is that you moved $900 million worth of cocaine.
Or more.
Or more. Which, in today's dollars, is the equivalent of $2.5 billion. So you were moving.
You figure like this here. If you do 100 kilos in one day, that cocaine goes a lot of places. You know, a lot of people, they taking it, they putting it on airplanes. You know, they moving it around. Now you're talking about you move 200 kilos in one day or 250. You're talking about that's a lot of cocaine.
Okay. If you were to stack up 250 kilos right now, how big would it be? Would it cover this entire room?
No. 250 kilos is not that big. Maybe the size of that couch.
That's it?
Yeah.
And that's the equivalent of $3 million?
According to what price you're getting.
Yeah.
What time it is. You know, one time I paid as much as $48,000 for a kilo. So... $3 million won't go for when you're buying them like that.
Right.
But if you're getting them for 10 a kilo, you can buy 300.
Okay.
So all that factors in, you know. And I, like I said, I paid as much as, I paid $3,300 for an ounce of cocaine. And if you add that up, you're talking about like $100,000 for 1 kilo. But for the whole kilo, I paid $48,000 cash for one, and I've also bought them for $9.5.
Right.
As low as $9.5.
So, how were you actually getting this much cocaine on a regular basis? Were you getting it once a week, every day?
100 keys every day.
You were getting 100 kilos every day.
My last 2 years, yeah, every day.
Every single day.
Oh, absolutely.
Can you say how you're actually getting it?
In the trunk of cars.
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing. Right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person, and they have food, and you have water, and they have no water, and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get by giving somebody else something they desire. The more value we create for other people, the more wealth we have. It's just that simple. Now, money is one of the stores of value. That's what money is. Money is a store of value, and it's also a way to transfer value. It's also a way to represent value that you've already created, right? So if you think about money as like a certification, right? Like it's a certificate that proves that you've created value for someone other than yourself, right? And so, like, if you go to Eddie V's and you're a nice person, right, and you say, well, I would like for y'all to serve me some food, they are going to say, okay, we'll serve you some food, but at the end, they expect you to produce proof that you serve somebody other than you, and that proof shows up in the way of money, right? Because that's all money does. Money shows people that you deserve to have somebody create value for you because you can prove you created value for someone else, right? And here's what's really cool. All of us are good at different things. So we all have different value that we can create for other people. And if we keep the value that we create to ourselves, it doesn't really do us that much good. But if we spread the value, the value that we create for other people, if we spread that around, then it becomes more valuable. Now here's what's really interesting. I can't create value for someone until I know what's valuable to that someone. So wealth creation has like a lot to do with discovery, like discovering what other people value. And if I'm going to know what other people value, then I got to know where do those values come from? Like, where do values come from? There are things you value that I don't value. There are things I value that you don't value, right? And there's things that we both value, but you might value more than me or I might value more than you. Huh. So where do our values come from? Okay, I believe the first place that values come from is past, perceived, I'm just going to do PERC, perceived voids create present pursued values. Are y'all tracking? Past perceived voids create present pursued values. What does that mean? That means if I feel like something was missing in the past, I will work in the present to fill the void that I had in the past, right? So that's why if people grow up in a place where they're in like dire hunger conditions or feast or famine, they value food like at a very high level, right? That's why people who, so for me, like, I like cars. I like them. I like cars. I grew up working on cars, right? But I grew up in a family where when I was growing up, my parents never bought a new car ever. They had seven boys. Here's what boys do. They eat you out of house and home, right? Boys can just, it's like they're a bottomless food pit, right? And I can remember, like, if I was in elementary school, if I was going to eat a sandwich, I wouldn't eat a sandwich. I'd eat two, three, or four sandwiches, right? But I like cars. And so we grew up with buying $50 cars, $100 cars, and then working on them and driving them until they broke down. Then we go buy another $50 car, $100 car, and we had no car payments, right? So I like cars. I used to see people with nice cars. I'm like, why do they have nice cars? We don't have nice cars, right? So that's a past perceived void in my life, right? So it became a present pursued value. Some people are like, why do you have all these expensive cars? Well, expensive is a relative term anyway. I don't even, like, that's really relative. Like, it depends on, like, what is expensive to you, right? So, but the reason I, like, have a collection of, I say a collection, I've got some very nice cars is because I like cars, because that was, for me, a past perceived void. I work out. Why do I work out? Because in the past, I've been out of shape. And in the past, my body hurt. The more out of shape I was, the more my body hurt. So that's a past perceived void that created a present pursued value. Are y'all tracking? And so a lot of times, we don't even know where these things that we value came from, right? I value entrepreneurship. Why? Because in the past, I used to have jobs. And they always came with a boss. And I don't know. The word boss means, like, they're going to be bossing me around. That's what, like, they're going to tell me, like, can I go? No. And I can't even finish the question, right? Can I have? No. And I don't like to have to ask for permission. I don't like permission. In fact, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. I'm that dude. Okay, I know none of you entrepreneurs are that way, right? So you started business because you love people telling you what to do. Okay, judgment-free zone. And so I like autonomy. My parents, great parents, they weren't perfect parents by any stretch of imagination, which is why I did not become a perfect parent. Okay, so but they were great parents for me and my brothers, right? And they were very authoritarian, It didn't matter if I was 7 or 17, why, the answer was always going to be the same. Because I said so. Right? So I liked autonomy. So when I wasn't at home, I didn't like teachers telling me what to do at school. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do at home. And then I got a job, and the boss wanted to tell me, and everybody wanted to tell me what to do. And I know it's my own little weirdness going on in my mind palace, but, like, you got yours, I got mine, and I don't like people telling me what to do. So I want to live as autonomous. Now, I want God to tell me what to do, but I don't like humans bossing me around, okay? Because their motive is suspect. God's motive is not suspect, right? Right? And that's why I don't like it when people on my team call me, oh, this is my boss. I'm not your boss. I don't even like the word boss. I don't have an outfit that matches a boss. You don't have an outfit that matches a boss. So unless we're talking about business optimization success secrets from boss moves, then again, that's a different story. But not bossing people around. Anyway, so y'all get it. Past perceived voids create present pursued values. But also, the second place values come from is present pursued. I don't think I spelled that right. Pursued victories. Create present pursued values. So present pursued victories, the things I'm working towards winning right now, will cause me to value that thing. And so I've got a value. I want to win. So because I want to win, okay, for instance, I'm going to put my son-in-law on blast. So my son-in-law, I mean, we're really, really close until we get on the golf course, and then we try to beat each other's brains out. It's great. Okay? So he wants to beat me really, really bad. I want to beat him really, really bad. And for a while, I just beat him all the time. And then, like, I lost my mojo, and then he beat me all the time. And he was sending his mom text messages like, there's a new sheriff in town. And then his mom would call me. And I'm like, is this really happening? Okay, cool. So I started working on my short game again. And so now it's like the last three tournaments we've had, we play three-round tournaments, and we have this trophy, and every time you win three rounds, you get to put your name on the trophy. No, it's not on the news, it's not on ESPN, nobody knows but us, but we relish this victory so much, right? And so what we do, because we both want to win, is we both spend time working on our game, because present pursued victories create present values. So the things that we felt like we're missing in the past, that creates value for us. The things that we're working on winning in the present, and then the last one is future pursued, I think I spelled that right, I don't know, pursued visions create present perceived values. So So what does that mean? That means I can see an outcome down the road that is worth sacrificing right now for, so I'll sacrifice the short term on the altar of the long term. I'll sacrifice, like, my pleasure right now because I've got this vision down the road, and I'll take some time off of playing golf, and I'll take some time off of practicing my guitar. I'll take some time off from something I want to do for me. Like, okay, give you for instance. I am a foodie. If I wanted to, I could easily weigh 400, 500, 600 pounds. It would be easy. Like, I like food. You say, what kind of food? Almost all kinds. I mean, I don't like pork, and I don't like shrimp, and I don't like yucky stuff. It's disgusting. But I like to eat. And the better it is, the more of it I like to eat. I'm just keeping it real. Like, brother man can throw it down. I can fling it down. Hear me when I tell you. I mean, where are my foodies? Where are my foodies? Okay? But because I have this future vision, right? Like, I've got this future vision. I've got a granddaughter. She's 3. One of the highlights of my life, my entire existence on this planet as a human, was when I got to dance with my daughter at her wedding. That was a highlight for me. Okay? So, one of my future visions that I have is to dance with my granddaughter, not at her wedding. My 3-year-old granddaughter. She's not going to get married at 3. That's not what I mean. Like, my granddaughter who is 3, when she becomes an adult, one of my objectives is to dance with her at her wedding. Well, let's say she gets married when she's 21, like my daughter did. Okay? She'll be 4 in July, so that gives me 17 more years. Well, in 17 years, I'll be 79, right? You know what that tells me? That tells me, as much as I love food, and I do love it, I don't like it, y'all. Hear me when I tell you. If I'm going to eat something, I want it to taste. I don't even want to waste any time eating food that don't taste good. Okay, y'all tracking. Like, I'm the guy who, when I make spaghetti, I season the water I boil my noodles in. I'm that dude. Okay, how many of y'all tracking? Okay, now y'all know who y'all dealing with. Okay, so, just keeping it real. Okay, so, but because I want to dance with my granddaughter at her wedding, when she gets married, I don't eat food until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I drink water in the morning, and I have a window to eat between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. It opens at 1 with a protein shake. Then I'll eat some snacks in between, like some carrot chips or some celery or something good with some different whatever dip I decide. I'll mix some honey mustard and some ranch, and I know that's not healthy. I don't really care. This is my vision, y'all. You do you. I'm going to do me. Okay, I know that's not the healthiest thing in the world, but it's what I do right now. So if y'all want me to do better, pray for me. Okay, so. And then I'll eat dinner. So that's, but I'm going to make sure my protein shake is really, really good. And I'm going to make sure my snacks are really, really good. And I'm going to make sure when I eat dinner, oh, look at him, is really, really good. Okay, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you my value comes from something that I desire that's way in the future, that I'm willing to sacrifice right now on, right? It's too many people, they don't understand that today is yesterday's tomorrow. And they act as if the actions they take today have no consequences in the future, right? And so the definition of sacrifice is to let go of something of a lower nature so you can take a hold of something of a higher nature. And the best way for us to live our lives, it's like it's been proven, it doesn't matter whether it's in finances, whether it's in health, whether it's in relationships, it doesn't matter what arena we're talking about, sacrificing the short term on the altar of the long term always ends better than sacrificing the long term on the altar of the short term. It always does. It's just like a principle of life. Okay, so now I know when I'm looking at my particular marketplace in whatever particular niche I'm looking at, then I know what I have to do if I want to create wealth is I have to figure out how to help somebody fill their past perceived voids or how to win their present pursued victories or how to fulfill their future pursued visions. How many of y'all check? How many of y'all check it? Tracking. Okay? So now when I'm looking at somebody, I know what kind of value, how to discover what you value. Because you're going to value one of those three things. Whatever you're working on in your life is probably going to fit into one of those three categories. Now, wealth is the result of value creation. The better your ability to create value for someone other than yourself, the wealthier you are. And sometimes that'll show up as money. Sometimes it'll show up as real estate. Sometimes it'll show up as like hard assets like gold and silver. But or it'll show up as digital assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But at the end of the day, whatever you pay for with money that you earned by creating value for someone other than yourself. So the very act of entrepreneurship, by its very nature, has to be self-sacrificing if you're going to win as an entrepreneur. How many of y'all got it? Wave at me. Say, I got it. Wave at me. Okay, good, cool. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at what God set up in Genesis chapter 1, and I call it the four levels of value. So because here's what y'all, like, here's one of the things I think we don't understand sometimes. All value is not created equally, right? What does that mean? All value is not created equally. So I can say, well, but I created this value. Yeah, but the problem is either you valued it or maybe one other person valued it. You wonder why. Like, if you're not doing well financially, I'm going to tell you why. Because the pool of people that you've decided to create value for is very small. Or the value that you've created for them, they value it at a very low level. Like, it's not like a big deal, right? I'm going to pay more for a car than I am for a pair of shoes. Why? That's a bigger value. Why? It can take me farther faster than a pair of shoes, right? So watch this. So, like, even if I go to eat at Ocean Prime or I go to eat at Eddie V's and it costs $500 for dinner for, like, seven people or whatever, I value that more than I value the money, number one. But I also value it because it gives me the time that I want to spend or invest into the people that I care about the most, and I don't have to, like, I don't have to make the food. My wife doesn't have to make the food. My daughter doesn't have to make the food. My son-in-law, we can just sit down. We can go to dinner. We can pay somebody. They make all the stuff. Like, we don't have to go in the kitchen and do anything. We don't even have to open the refrigerator. It's amazing. They just keep bringing it to you. And then you don't have to clean off the table. I mean, if you don't want to, you don't even have to put your own pepper on your food. They'll put the pepper on for you. This is amazing. And then when you get done, you don't have to clean the table up. You don't have to wash any dishes. You just leave. What? Sign me up right now. How many of y'all checking? Like, so we have to get to the place in our lives where we realize that all value is not created equally, right? So while I'm giving you things that are not created equally, let me give you something that is created equally. Because all value is not created equally, all no's are created equally, but all yeses are not. What do I mean all no's are created equally? If you do a presentation to a potential client who does not have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no, it feels the exact same as if you do a presentation to somebody who does have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no. A no is 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 a no. Does that make sense? Okay. But if you talk to somebody who does not have the ability to take advantage of your offer, and you make an offer to that person, and they say yes, that's very different than when you talk to a person who has the desire to take advantage of your offer, and they say yes. They have the ability. One has the ability, one doesn't have the ability. Those are two very different yeses. All no's are created equally. All yeses are not. Why would you invest time talking to people who have neither the desire nor the willingness to buy your offer? That's why I don't do high-pressure sales. I'm just not interested in it. I don't need your money. I don't want your money. And if I got to drag you in, I'm going to have to drag you around. Like we would all do better if we would just realize there are already thousands, potentially tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people in the world who would love to purchase the value that we create if they only knew we existed. And if that were really the case, then I would be better off to spend my time to make myself findable than I am trying to find somebody to sell something to. Is what I'm saying making sense? Okay, so all value is not created equally. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God gave us the four levels of value. The lowest level of value is implementation. Implementation, oh, by the way, let me say this. Wealth is, it's like the value we create for other people, but here's what we have to understand about wealth. Wealth is a spiritual result. What do I mean wealth is a spiritual result? Well, let me ask you a question. Is it more spiritual for you to think about you or for you to think about someone else? Which one? Someone else. It's more spiritual for you to think about solving the problems of someone other than you. Okay? So wealth is a spiritual result. By the way, wealth is also a spiritual result because creativity is spiritual, right? And so if you're going to create value for somebody, that's also spiritual. So watch this. So the lowest level of value is implementation. What do I mean? This is like if you're on this level of value, if you're creating value for other people at the implementation level, you have limited. Who's limited? Everybody tap yourself on the chest, say I have. You've limited your ability to earn. Why? Because you're only going to make somewhere between minimum wage and about $80,000 a year. Well, that sounds kind of painful. Why? Because you're using muscles, which are a physical resource, over time, which is a limited resource. So you're literally using a physical resource over a limited resource to produce an unlimited spiritual result. No wonder you're stuck. This is why I tell people, now, if you just love like mowing grass and you want to start a lawn care company, that's fine. You just love pressure washing, you want to start a pressure washing business, that's fine. You can make money and create a limited level of wealth with a pressure washing business. You can. Or a landscape business or a janitorial service. But here's the problem. You're anchoring your income generation to time and physical labor. That is always going to pay you at the lowest possible level. Why? Because muscles are a physical resource. Time is a limited resource. Wealth is an unlimited spiritual result. Okay, what's the next level? The next level is unification. Unification on this level, you're going to make somewhere between $40,000 a year and maybe if you're like at a Fortune 500, Fortune 100 company, you might make $250,000 a year. Well, that, how many of y'all know $40,000 to $250,000 is better than minimum wage to $80,000, right? That's a better window. But, I mean, do you really, and maybe you do, but do you really want a whole year to go by and you only make $250,000? I mean, that's a question we have to answer for ourselves. And for some people, the answer is like, man, if I had a year went by, I made $250,000, that's more than $20,000 a month. Sign me up right now. Okay, great. Sign you up right now, but probably not sign you up forever, right? Can I get a witness, right? Like, it's not a bad place to start, but it's not where we want to land, okay? What is this? This unification on this level, the resource we use on this level is our management skills. Managing people is a higher spiritual activity than doing the thing yourself. Are y'all tracking? That's why when people get into management, they make more. This person over here, they're making tacos at Taco Bell. They're making minimum wage. This person might be a mechanic working at a Rolls-Royce dealership or maybe a Mercedes dealership or BMW dealership. This person right here is managing Taco Bell. This person right here is a middle manager at Lockheed Martin. But the reality is if some company is paying you $250,000 a year, they want you to know they own you. Am I telling the truth? They want you to know. They don't just want you to know they own you. They want you to know they know it. Right? And so like, if that's what you desire, that's fine. But maybe there's a way to have a level of freedom beyond that. And I believe that wealth begins to be created above this line. Wealth begins on the level of communication. Communication, on the level of communication. Now, somebody said the quality of your life will be equal to the quality of your communication. Okay? So communication, the resource you use on this level is your mouth. Now, there's a caveat. You have to have a mouth. You have to be willing to learn to use it. To do what? Create messages that move the masses. It's amazing. It's amazing that this, all of this, is harder than this. But to become a person who's skilled at this is harder than just doing this. What do I mean? Some people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they don't have to develop a level of verbal diligence and verbal intelligence and verbal acuity. Right? I don't want to have to learn how to talk, so I'm just going to go ahead and keep on working my fingers to the bone. Well, that's one way to do it. Right? Okay. Well, so communication. On this level, low end, you should make at least $100,000 a year. If you can sell cars, you can make $100,000 a year selling cars, selling insurance. Right? Selling advertising, $100,000 a year. But on the high end, might make $100 million. Why? Because you're using your mouth to deliver value. Well, Myron, what do you mean $100,000? Like, you know who these people are? These people are salespeople, right? They're also authors. They write books. Like, our books probably make us $400,000 a year. Just books. I wrote them once, just get paid for them every day. What is it? It's a message communicated. It's like these words that came to my mind, and they actually came out of my mouth. Like, I communicated a message that makes me hundreds of... I communicated messages. One of the books I wrote in 2006. This is 2023. That's 17 years. This book has been making me money for 17 years. We sold over 160,000 copies of this one book. Now, who could write a book? Anybody could. Who will write a book? Almost no one. Okay, so, these people are coaches and teachers and actors and songwriters and playwrights, right? Please don't let me forget this one. And YouTubers. It's crazy town. YouTube. Don't even get me started on YouTube, y'all. I might not be able to get off of it. Like, YouTube? I had no idea. I've been on YouTube since 2007. I didn't even know there was a thing called turning on monetization until 2020. How many years is that? 15. I think it's 15. Ain't that 15? 15 years. I was on YouTube for 15 years. I didn't know all I had to do was click a button. They start paying me. Click a button. Like, this is how long it takes to click a button. Click. Get paid. I mean, I wasn't creating new videos. I had like 40 videos on. We turned on monetization. Did no new videos. The first month, didn't do any new videos. Hadn't done any new videos in like 8 months. Turned on monetization, and we got paid $305. And Zach's like, we made $305 last month. And I said, for what? Because somewhere along the line, I communicated a message somebody wanted to see, and Google or YouTube was able to sell an ad on that. We're talking about 200. This is amazing. I looked at it yesterday. I didn't know this was going to happen, so I didn't do it for this reason. Are y'all tracking? What I'm about to tell you, I did not do for the reason I'm about to tell you what happened, okay? So we started doing YouTube videos intentionally April 1st last year. I looked at it yesterday. In the last 365 days, as of yesterday, we made $289,000 that YouTube paid us. I didn't know they were going to do that. No, you don't understand. I had no idea they were going to do that. Like, that wasn't why I did it. I mean, it was a nice side benefit, right? I've never had a job where I made $280,000 in my life. Most I've ever made at a job is $30,000, ever, as a full-grown man with a family. And you two paid me $289,000 for turning on a camera and running my mouth? Where the camera? Turn on the camera. I got something to say. The highest level of value is imagination. It still blows my mind. The resource you use at this level is your mind and your money to make money, to create value for other people. And what happens is at this level, on the low end, you're going to make $1 million. On the high end, it could be billions. And I know that sounds crazy. There's one YouTuber. This dude has 150 million subscribers. He gets over 100 million views a month. 100 million views. If he only makes $2 a view, that's 200 million a month. Are y'all tracking? It's just the whole world that we live in is kind of insanical. It's kind of the combination of insane and maniacal put together. So we can fight to stay down here, and people will do it too, because this, everything you do down here is hard. But I don't know if anything's harder than thinking. Thinking is the hardest work most people never do. In fact, I believe that most people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they can maintain a state of mental laziness. They will work hard at what's not working so they don't have to think about what would work. Most people will work hard at what's not working so they won't have to think about what would work. They will maintain a state of physical diligence, like working their fingers to the bone, sweat, blood, tears, so they don't have to think about what would work. So they can maintain a state of mental laziness. Most people are so mentally lazy, it's pathetic. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Myron, I don't know what Bible you've been reading. I did not see that in chapter 1. Okay, I'm going to read it to you. It's kind of mind-blowing. So a couple things. One is that Genesis chapter 1, I believe, if all God wanted us to know from Genesis chapter 1 was that he created everything, Genesis chapter 1 could have been Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Then he starts going into all this detail. And the earth was without form and void and darkness upon the face of the deep. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light, that it was good. Like, what is all that about? Well, the first thing God tells about God is not that he is love, even though he's love. It's not that he's holy, even though he's holy. The first thing that God tells about God is not that he's omniscient or omnipresent or omnipotent, even though he is all those things. The first thing God tells about God is that he's creative. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. What's the first thing God tells about us? The first thing he tells about us is that he created us in his image, which means he created us to create stuff, and he made us to make stuff. What does that mean? What that means is, when God created everything, after he created everything, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. After he did it, then he went back and documented the process, so when we got ready to create value for someone else, we'd have a pattern. In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. That was his intention. And the earth was without form. That word was not, used to be, it became, without form and void. So disruption always follows intention, and darkness upon the face of the deep. So when disruption comes, it comes in the form of devoidness, deformity, and darkness. Like things get broken. There's confusion. Darkness is a picture of confusion and fear and anxiety. And then the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the water. So you have this intention, and then disruption follows your intention. So now you've got to find a source of inspiration.
I have to open up my mic. Okay, we've been on here a little bit over 10 years, 10 and a half years so far, and had a name changer too, Sack Lunch Shacks. That's our current podcast name, but everything that we started out with, It's My House, all that's still in the archives. We've got over 2,000 over 2,500 podcasts archived. So you can go back to day one and pick out any one you want to play. We've covered a variety of topics. But now, moving forward, we're developing a brand or based on a theme. And I'm calling that, this is Ancestralnomics. And I came up with this based on the various topics that we've covered over the years. And this name came up, Ancestralnomics. And let me give you a definition of it, because this is something I coined. Based on the hundreds of hours, if not a few thousand, hours of talk. Ancestralnomics, the study and training of how to recognize, convert, and monetize ancestral wealth into income-producing assets using social capital, period. I'll read it again, the definition of ancestralnomics. Most of you have never heard of ancestralnomics, because basically the word was invented less than 24 hours ago. Ancestralnomics is the study and training of how to recognize, convert, and monetize ancestral wealth into income-producing assets using social capital. Many people, when they have a relative that passes on and becomes an ancestor, in many cases, they don't leave a will behind or a trust of any kind, but they leave bills behind. And sometimes the ones that are left among the living do not know how to pay those bills, because some of those bills could be astronomical. Well, ancestralnomics, which is one word, to the rescue. Everybody leaves something behind. Oftentimes, you're told or given specific instructions while they were still living. Now, sometimes those instructions could be given directly, sometimes indirectly. Sometimes they might not have said anything to you directly or indirectly, but it's something that they did. Maybe it was a recipe, maybe it was a work ethic. It can take, Mignon Francois, she got her water cut back on, got her lights cut back, electricity in her home cut back on, was able to feed her family of seven kids, get the house out of foreclosure. Why? How? It was from a recipe for cupcakes that her grandmother gave her. That's ancestralnomics. Once again, the definition is the study and training of how to recognize. He recognized that making cupcakes could get her out of debt. How to convert. She took that cupcake recipe and converted it into the Cupcake Collection, which is a business which has a location in New Orleans, Louisiana, and one in Nashville, Tennessee. And, of course, she took that cupcake recipe, turned it into a business, a Cupcake Collection. That whole thing is called monetization of ancestral wealth. The ancestral wealth was her grandmother's cupcake recipe, and turn it into an income-producing asset using social capital. She didn't know how to make cupcakes, but her daughters did, or one or two of her daughters did. And that's how they got started. So we're going to go into more detail on this every week. And if you have a story that you would like to share with us on how you took some type of recipe, it could be a quilt, it could be something that they sold together. Maybe they taught you how to sew. Maybe your favorite meal. But every person has something, and probably in most cases many things, that were left behind, that if you would recognize it, and it only takes one item or the thing. It can be tangible or intangible. Could be a lifestyle. But if you recognize it and convert it and monetize that ancestral wealth and turn it into an income-producing asset, the back taxes that you might owe, your pension fund, money for anything can be manifested. So if you got any stories to share with us, contact us ASAP. On that note, everyone have a good weekend. Think about what kind of wealth did your ancestor leave behind. Forget about the dollars and cents. Forget about the bank accounts. Forget about the wills or the trust that was left behind. There are other things that they left behind. Think on it. Talk to you Monday.
The Virginia Lottery has three new Let's Make a Deal games, which means three ways to play your favorite game show. The Let's Make a Deal Print and Play has a top prize of $30,000. The Scratcher has a top prize of $100,000. And the online game could win you up to $500,000. Play Let's Make a Deal from the Virginia Lottery in stores, in the app, or online today. Visit VALottery.com/deal. Let's Make a Deal, licensed by Fremantle, all rights reserved.
At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking car off business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.